You're listening to the Berkshire Hathaway Annual Shareholders Meeting Podcast, brought to you exclusively by Yahoo Finance.
Amendment, 1920. It took 61 more years until a woman was allowed to join those eight males on the Supreme Court. I grew up thinking that the Supreme Court, you know, must have been someone that said it had to be nine men. But it 61 years, so it took 192 years before Sandra Day O'Connor was appointed to the court. And now you can say that there was a pipeline problem. You know, half the population may have been women in 1920, but they weren't half the lawyers, or they weren't 10% of the lawyers probably. So you can understand some delay, but 61 years is a long time to go and to pick 33 males in between. If that was entirely by chance, then the odds against that, if you were flipping coins, is about 8 billion to 1. Now, like I said, there was a pipeline problem. But it took us a long, long time. And it's not done yet. But I think it does give meaning to the fact that we are a better society with a lot of room to go. But we are a better society than existed in 1789. When you go to Colonial Williamsburg, you have that. I've been there a couple of times. As a matter of fact, I watched the debate between Jimmy Carter and Gerald Ford there in 1976. It was not a great time to be black. It was not a great time to be a woman. And both of those categories still have certainly got potential for significant improvement in terms of fulfilling that pledge made in 1776 about how we believe that it's self-evident all men were created equal. But we have made progress. We are a better society, and we will, as the years go by. If you'll move to the next slide. And I believe that. And I think, let's see if I can get these slides in the proper order here. I believe that when you get through evaluating all of the qualitative facts, what we have done toward meeting the aspirations of what we wrote in 1776. We wrote in 1776 wasn't a fact, but it was an aspirational document, and we have worked toward those aspirations, and we have a long way to go, but I'll repeat, if you'll move to the next slide, that never, never against America. Now, let's move on now to a broad, much broader subject, what I don't know. And I don't know, and perhaps with a bias, I don't believe anybody knows what the market is going to do tomorrow, next week, next month, next year. I know America's going to move forward over time, but I don't know for sure. And we learned this on September 10th, 2001, and we learned it a few months ago in terms of the virus. Anything can happen in terms of markets. And if you can bet on America, but you have to be careful about how you bet. Because simply because markets can do anything. On October, whatever it was in 1987, October 11th, I believe, Monday, you know, markets went down 22% in one day. In 1914, they closed the stock market for about 4 months. After 9/11, closed the market for 4 days. We hustled to get it going again. But nobody knows what's going to happen tomorrow. So when you bet, I tell you to bet on America. And I tell you that that's what's really gotten me through ever since I was bought my first stock when I was 11. I mean, I caught a huge, huge, huge tailwind in America, but it wasn't going to blow in my direction every single day, and you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. And I would like to, in the context of the present news, point out something you may find kind of interesting. If you go to YouTube, you'll find on June 17th of 2015, 4+ years ago, you'll find Sam Nunn, who's one of the people I admire the most in the United States, in the world, enormous patriot, tremendous senator, and he's carried on thankless work since leaving the Senate, and I'd say heading something called the Nuclear Threat Initiative, which most of you haven't heard of, but I've been slightly involved in it. Sam Nunn founded that. And the Nuclear Threat Initiative, simply organizations that devoted to trying to reduce the chances of something of a nuclear, chemical, biological, and now cyber nature from either malevolent or accidental or whatever it may be, from causing deaths to millions of Americans. And among the things that Sam co-founded it, but he's been the heart and soul of the organization subsequently. And he's talked about, worried about pandemics along with the nuclear threat for decades. And he's participated in war games where they play out various scenarios, including malevolent pandemics that could be started by the same kind of nut that sent the anthrax letters in around 9/11, a little after. And Sam appeared on this YouTube presentation, and I'm sure he's been on many others. I just happened to look this one up, and talked about the dangers of a pandemic, and anybody should listen to Sam Nunn anytime he talks. So he said at that time, germs don't have borders, which we've certainly learned in the last couple of months. And when I clicked on YouTube, if you'll go to the next, I found out that it had 831 views. And this was only a few days ago. I looked it up, and maybe, I don't know whether most of those views have just been the last few days because of the interest in pandemics. But it is hard to think about things that haven't happened yet. So we can experience, when something like the current pandemic happens, it's hard to factor that in, and that's why you never want to use borrowed money, and at least in my view, margin to buy into investments. And we run Berkshire that way. We run it so that we literally try to think of the worst case of not only just one thing going wrong, but other things going wrong at the same time. maybe partly caused by the first, but maybe independent even of the first. And, you know, that you learned in, I don't know what grade now, probably earlier than when I went to school, but in fifth or sixth grade, that anything, you can have any series of numbers times zero and just need one zero in there and the answer is zero. And there's no reason to use borrowed money to participate in the American tailwind, but there's every other reason to participate. Now, I can't resist pointing out that in October of 2019, a large 300-page, I've got it right here, book was brought out, and Johns Hopkins, one of the most respected institutions in the country, the Nuclear Threat Initiative, NTI, and the intelligence group at The Economist collaborated to evaluate the problems of the worldwide preparedness for pandemics, essentially. And I think in November, Sam came out to see me with Ernie Moritz, former Secretary of Energy, who now is the CEO of NTI. He and Sam are co-chairmen. And Beth Cameron, who did a lot of work on this report, came out to see me. And they gave me, in November, I believe, of last year, they gave me this appraisal. And the opening line, if you'll turn the page, this is the opening line of this 300-page tome. Biological threats, natural, intentional, or accidental, in any country can pose risk to global health, international security, and the worldwide economy. And this book was prepared in order to evaluate the preparedness of the various countries and rank them. We ranked pretty well, but all of us got a failing, all of the countries got a failing grade, basically. Now, you would think with the prestige of Johns Hopkins and The Economist, along with people like Sam and Ernie, et cetera, that this would have gotten some attention. And again, Sam, you'll turn to the next page, Sam and the others went on YouTube on October 24th, 2019, and they have racked up, as of a couple of days ago, 1,498 views. Now, my friend Bill Gates was delivering the same warning at a TED Talk some years back, and he's gotten a lot more views, but it just says something about the fact that you're going to get bolts from the blue, and you can read papers about them, and you can talk about what'll happen if some, as they used to, the fellows at Sigma, Solomon used to tell me, some 25 Sigma event comes along, and they, you know, they say this, that'll happen once in the life of the universe, you know, and then it happens to them a couple of times in a month, and they go broke. You just don't know what's going to happen. You know, at least in my view, you know that America's tailwind is not exhausted. You're going to get a fine result if you own equities over a long period of time. And the idea that equities will not produce better results than the 30-year Treasury bond, which yields 1.25% now, it's taxable income. It's the aim of the Federal Reserve to have 2% a year inflation. Equities are going to outperform that bond. They're going to outperform Treasury bills. They're going to outperform that money you've stuck under your mattress. I mean, they are an enormously sound investment, as long as they're an investment and they're not a gambling device or something that you think you can safely, you know, buy on margin or whatever it may be. It's interesting that stocks offer, which, and stocks are a, we always look at stocks as just being a part of a business. I mean, stocks are a small part of a business. If in 1789 you'd saved a small amount of money, and it wasn't easy to save, you might have bought, with those savings, you might have bought a tiny, tiny plot of property. Maybe you bought a house that could be rented to somebody, but you didn't really have the chance to buy in with 10 different people who were developing businesses and who were putting, presumably putting their own money in, and that would have the American tailwind behind. And of the 10, a reasonably high percentage would succeed in a way and earn decent returns. But those are the choices you might have had to do with savings. And they started offering bonds originally, and there again you got a limited return, but the return may have been, in those days, may have been 5 or 6% or something of the sort. But you can't buy risk-free bonds. I mean, the yardstick for me is always the U.S. Treasury, and when somebody offers you quite a bit more than the U.S. Treasury, there's usually a reason. There's more risk. But going back to stocks, people bring the attitude to them too often that because they are liquid and quoted minute by minute, that it's an important that you develop an opinion on them minute by minute. Now, that's really foolish when you think about it. And that's something Graham taught me in 1949. I mean, that single thought, stocks were parts of businesses and not just little things that moved around on charts, or charts were very popular in those days, and whatever it may be. Imagine for a moment that you decided to invest money now and you bought a farm. And the farmland around here, let's say you bought 160 acres and you bought it at X per share or per acre. And the farmer next to you had 160 identical acres, same contour, you know, same quality of soil quality. So it was identical. And that farmer next door to you was a very peculiar character, because every day that farmer with the identical farm said, "I'll sell you my farm, or I'll buy your farm at a certain price," which he would name. Now, that's a very obliging neighbor. I mean, that's got to be a plus to have a fellow like that with the next farm. You don't get that with farms. You get it with stocks. You own 100 shares of General Motors. You know, on Monday morning, somebody will buy your 100 shares or sell you another 100 shares at exactly the same price, and that goes on, you know, 5 days a week. But just imagine if you had a farmer doing that. When you bought the farm, you looked to what the farm would produce. That was what went through your mind. You're saying to yourself, "I'm paying X dollars per acre. I think I'll get so many bushels of corn or soybeans on average. Some years good, some years bad. Some years the price will be good, some years the price will be bad, et cetera." But you think about the potential of the farm. And now you get this idiot that buys a farm next to you, and on top of that, he's sort of a manic depressive and drinks, maybe smokes a little pot. So his numbers just go all over the place. Now, the only thing you have to do is to remember that this guy next door is there to serve you and not to instruct you. You bought the farm because you thought the farm was had the potential. You don't really need a quote on it. You know, if you bought in with John D. Rockefeller or Andrew Carnegie, and there were never any quotes. Well, there were quotes later on, but basically, You bought into the business. And that's what you're doing when you buy stocks. But you get this added advantage that you do have this neighbor who you're not obliged to listen to at all, who is going to give you a price every day, and he's going to have his ups and downs. And maybe he'll name a selling price that he'll buy at, in which case you sell if you want to. Or maybe he'll name a very low price and you'll buy his farm from him. But you don't have to. And you don't want to put yourself in a position to where you have to. So stocks have this enormous inherent advantage of people yelling out prices all the time to you. And many people turn that into a disadvantage. And of course, many people can profit in one way or another from telling you that they can tell you what this farmer's going to yell out tomorrow or next, your neighboring farmer's going to yell out tomorrow or next week or next month. There's huge money in it. So people tell you that it's important and they know, and that you should pay a lot of attention to their thoughts about what price changes should be, or you tell yourself that there should be this great difference. But the truth is, if you owned the businesses you liked prior to the virus arriving, it changes prices and it changes, but nobody's forcing you to sell. And if you really like the business and you like the management you're in with, and the business hasn't fundamentally changed, and I'll get to that a little when I report on Berkshire, which I will soon, I promise. Stocks have an enormous advantage, and you still can bet on America, but you can't bet unless you're willing and have an outlook to independently decide that you want to own a cross-section of America, because I don't think most people are in a position to pick single stocks. A few maybe, but on balance, I think people are much better off buying a cross-section of America and just forgetting about it. If you'd done that, if I'd done that when I got out of college, it's all I had to do to make 100 for one and then collect dividends on top of it, which would increase substantially over time. The American tailwind is marvelous. American business represents it, and it's going to have interruptions, and you're not going to foresee the interruptions, and you do not want to get yourself in a position where those interruptions can affect you, either because you're leveraged or because you're psychologically unable to handle looking at a bunch of numbers. If you really had a farm, and you had this neighbor, and one day he offered you $2,000 an acre, and the next day he offers you $1,200 an acre, and maybe the day after that he offers you $800 an acre, are you really going to feel that at $2,000 an acre, when you had evaluated what the farm would produce, are you going to let this guy drive you into thinking, I better sell, because his number keeps coming in lower all the time? It's a very, very, very important matter to bring the right psychological approach to owning common stocks. But I will tell you, if you bet on America and sustain that position for decades, you're going to do better than in my view, far better than owning Treasury securities, or far better than following people who tell you that what the farmer's going to yell out next. There's huge amounts of money that people pay for advice they really don't need, and for advice where the person giving it can be very well-meaning in it and believe their own line. But the truth is that you can't deliver superior results to everybody by just having them trade around a business. If you bought into a business, it's going to deliver what the business produces, and the idea that you can outsmart the person next to you, or that the person advising you can outsmart the person sitting next to you is it's really the wrong approach. So find businesses, get a cross section. In my view, for most people, the best thing to do is to own the S&P 500 index fund. People will try and sell you other things because there's more money in it for them if they do. And I'm not saying that that's a conscious act on their part. Most good salespeople believe their own baloney. I mean, that's part of being a good salesperson. And I'm sure I've done plenty of that in my life, too. But it's very human. If you keep repeating something often enough, that's why lawyers get, the witnesses keep saying things over and over again. But by the time they get on the witness stand, they'll believe it, whether it was true in the first place or not. But you are dealing with something fundamentally advantageous, in my view, in owning common stocks. I will bet on America the rest of my life, and I hope my successors at Berkshire do it. Now, we do it in two different ways. We do it by buying entire businesses, and we buy parts of businesses. And I would like to emphasize that, well, I'd like to give you a few figures that will tie in from our activities in the first quarter and also what we've done in April. We are not right about, we do try to pick businesses that we think we understand. We don't buy the S&P 500. But, and we like to buy the entire businesses when we buy them. But we don't get a chance to do that very often. Most of the best businesses are not available for sale in their entirety. But we don't mind in the least buying partial interests in businesses. And we would rather own 6 or 7 or 8% of a wonderful company and regard it as a partnership interest, essentially, in that company. And then we get an opportunity to do that through marketable securities, and sometimes we get more opportunities than others. And with that, I hope I've convinced you to bet on America. I'm not saying that this is the right time to buy stocks. If you mean by right that they're going to go up instead of down, I don't know what they're going to go in the next day or week or month or year, but I hope I know enough to know. Well, I think I can buy a cross section and do fine over 20 or 30 years. And you may think that's kind of for a guy 89 that taking kind of an optimistic viewpoint. I hope that really everybody would buy stocks with the idea that they're buying partnerships and businesses, and they wouldn't look at them as chips to move around up or down. We will just now take a quick look. And I see we've got Becky's email address. So if you have questions on what I've said or other things, you can email these questions. And she is back there, probably sort of a madhouse trying to handle questions coming in and pick out the one she's going to prioritize. But feel free to anything I've talked about so far to send along to her. And we'll keep her address up when I later hold the formal part of the meeting, too. Very briefly, in terms of Berkshire, in the first quarter, you'll put up. We have the slides on that. There we are. Our operating earnings were, and there's much more about this.
Thanks for listening to this section of the Berkshire Hathaway's annual shareholders meeting podcast. The next section can be found in the next episode in your podcast feed. So please go check it out. If you enjoy this podcast, leave us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts.